Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 200th of the Cthulhu Podcast. That's enough of that. I'm Felbrig, and today we're starting off with the next part of our World War I adventure, Greenmantle. And then we'll have a musical number from, I think it's 1929, and then back to The King in Yellow with part two of Demoiselle d'Ys. Let's get started. Chapter 20. Peter Pinard Goes to the Wars. This chapter is the tale that Peter told me, long after, sitting beside a stove in the hotel at Bergen, where we were waiting for our boat. He climbed on the roof and shinned down the broken bricks of the outer wall. The outbuilding we were lodged in abutted a road and was outside the proper enceinte of the house. At ordinary times, I have no doubt that there were sentries, but Sandy and Hussin had probably managed to clear them off this end for a little while. Anyhow, he saw nobody as he crossed the road and dived into the snowy fields. He knew very well that he must do the job in the 12 hours of darkness ahead of him. The immediate front of a battle is a bit too public for anyone to lie hidden in by day, especially when 2 or 3 feet of snow make everything kenspeckle. Now hurry in a job of this kind was abhorrent to Peter's soul, for like all boars, his tastes were for slowness and sureness, though he could hustle fast enough when haste was needed. As he pushed through the winter fields, he reckoned up the things in his favour, and found the only one, the dirty weather. There was a high gusty wind, blowing scuds of snow, but never coming to any great fall. The frost had gone, and the lying snow was as soft as butter. But that was all to the good, he thought, for a clear hard night would have been the very devil. The first bit was through farmlands, which were seamed with little snow-filled water furrows. Now and then he would come to a house and a patch of fruit trees, but there was nobody abroad. The roads were crowded enough, but Peter had no use for roads. I can picture him swinging along with his bent back, stopping every now and then to sniff and listen, alert for the foreknowledge of danger. When he chose, he could cover country like an antelope. Soon he struck a big road full of transport. It was the road from Erzrium to the Plantunken Pass, and he waited his chance and crossed it. After that the ground grew rough with boulders and patches of thorn trees, splendid cover when you could move fast without worrying. And then he was pulled up suddenly on the bank of a river. The map had warned him of it, but not that it would be so big. It was a torrent, swollen with melting snow and rains in the hills, and it was running 50 yards wide. Peter thought he could have swum it, but he was very averse to a drenching. A wet man makes too much noise, he said, and besides, there was the off chance that the current would be too much for him. So he moved upstream to look for a bridge. In 10 minutes he found one, a new-made thing of trestles, broad enough to take transport wagons. It was guarded, for he heard the tramp of a sentry, and as he pulled himself up the bank he observed a couple of long wooden huts, obviously some kind of billets. These were on the near side of the stream, about 12 yards from the bridge. A door stood open and a light showed in it, and from within came the sound of voices. Peter had a sense of hearing like a wild animal, and he could detect even the confused gabble of those voices, and know that they were German. As he lay and listened, someone came over the bridge. It was an officer, for the sentry saluted. The man disappeared in one of the huts. Peter had struck the billets and repairing shop of a squad of German sappers. He was just going ruefully to retrace his steps and try to find a good place to swim the stream, when it struck him that the officer who had passed him wore clothes very like his own. He too had a grey sweater and a balaclava helmet, for even a German officer ceases to be dressy on a mild winter's night in Anatolia. The idea came to Peter to walk boldly across the bridge and trust to the sentry not seeing the difference. He slipped round a corner of the hut and marched down the road. The sentry was now at the far end, which was lucky, for if the worst came to the worst, he could throttle him. Peter, mimicking the stiff German walk, swung past him, his head down as if to protect him from the wind. The man saluted. He did more, for he offered conversation. The officer must have been a genial soul. "It's a rough night, Captain," he said in German. "The wagons are late. Pray God Michael hasn't got a shell in his lot. They've begun putting over some big ones." Peter grunted good night in German and strode on. He was just leaving the road when he heard a great halloo behind him. The real officer must have appeared on his heels, and the sentry's doubts had been stirred. A whistle was blown, and looking back, Peter saw lanterns waving in the gale. They were coming out to look for the duplicate. He stood still for a second and noticed the light spreading out south of the road. He was just about to dive off the north side when he was aware of a difficulty. On that side, a steep bank fell to a ditch, and the bank beyond bounded on a big flood. He could see the dull ruffle of the water under the wind. On the road itself, he would soon be caught. South of it, the search was beginning, and the ditch itself was no place to hide, for he saw a lantern moving up it. Peter dropped into it all the same and made a plan. The side below the road was a little undercut and very steep. He resolved to plaster himself against it, for he would be hidden from the road, and a searcher in the ditch would be likely not to explore the unbroken sides. It was always a maxim of Peter's that the best hiding place was the worst, and the least obvious to the minds of those who were looking for you. He waited until the lights both in the road and the ditch came nearer, and then he gripped the edge with his left hand, where some stones gave him a purchase. He dug his toes of his boots into the wet soil and stuck like a limpet. It needed some strength to keep the position for long, but the muscles of his arms and legs were like whipcord. The searcher in the ditch soon got tired, for the place was very wet, and joined his comrades on the road. They came along, running, flashing the lanterns into the trench and exploring all the immediate countryside. Then rose a noise of wheels and horses from the opposite direction. Michael and the delayed wagons were approaching. They dashed up at a great pace, driven wildly, and for one horrid second Peter thought they were going to spill into the ditch at the very spot where he was concealed. The wheels passed so close to the edge that they almost grazed his fingers. Somebody shouted an order and they pulled up a yard or two nearer the bridge. The others came up and there was a consultation. Michael swore as he had passed no one on the road. "That fool Hannes has seen a ghost," said the officer testily. "It's too cold for this child's play." Hannes, almost in tears, repeated his tale. "The man spoke to me in good German," he cried. "Ghost or no ghost, he is safe enough up the road," said the officer. "Kind God, that was a big one." He stopped and stared at a shell burst, for the bombardment from the east was growing fiercer. They stood discussing the fire for a minute and presently moved off. Peter gave them 2 minutes more and then clambered back onto the highway and set off along it at a run. The noise of the shelling and the wind together with the thick darkness made it safe to hurry. He left the road at the first chance and took to the broken country. The ground was now rising towards a spur of the Palantirken, on the far slope of which were the Turkish trenches. The night had begun by being pretty nearly as black as pitch. Even the smoke from the shell explosions, which is often visible in darkness, could not be seen. But as the wind blew the snow clouds athwart the sky, patches of stars came out. Peter had a compass, but he didn't need to use it, for he had a kind of feel for landscape, a special sense which is born in savages and can only be acquired after long experience by the white man. I believe he could smell where the north lay. He had settled roughly which part of the line he would try, merely because of its nearness to the enemy. But he might see reason to vary this, and as he moved he began to think that the safer place was where the shelling was hottest. He didn't like the notion, but it sounded sense. Suddenly he began to puzzle over queer things in the ground, and as he had never seen big guns before, it took him a moment to fix them. Presently one went off at his elbow with a roar like a last day. These were the Austrian howitzers, nothing over 8 inch, I fancy, but to Peter they looked like leviathans. Here too, he saw for the first time a big and quite recent shell hole, for the Russian guns were searching out the position. He was so interested in it all that he poked his nose where he shouldn't have been and dropped plumb into the pit behind a gun emplacement. Gunners all over the world are the same, shy people, who hide themselves in holes and hibernate and mortally dislike being detected. A gruff voice cried, "Veda!" and a heavy hand seized his neck. Peter was ready with his story. He belonged to Michael's wagon team and had been left behind. He wanted to be told the way to the sapper's camp. He was very apologetic, not to say obsequious. "It is one of the Prussian swine from the Marta Bridge," said a gunner. "Land him a kick to teach him more sense. Bear to the right, mannequin, and you'll find a road. And have a care when you get there, for the Ruskies are registering on it." Peter thanked him and bore off to the right. After that, he kept a wary eye on the howitzers and was thankful when he got out of their area onto the slopes of the hill. Here was the type of country that was familiar to him, and he defied any Turk or Boche to spot him amongst the scrub and boulders. He was getting on very well, when once more, close to his ear, came a sound like the crack of doom. It was the field guns now, and the sound of a field gun close at hand is bad for the nerves if you aren't expecting it. Peter thought he'd been hit and lay flat for a little while to consider. And then he found the right explanation and crawled forward very warily. Presently he saw his first Russian shell. It dropped half a dozen yards to his right, making a great hole in the snow and sending up a mass of mixed earth, snow and broken stones. Peter spat out the dirt and felt very solemn. You must remember that never in his life had he seen big shelling, and was now being landed in the thick of a first-class show without any preparation. He said he felt cold in his stomach, and very wishful to run away. If there had been anywhere to run to, he would have. But he kept on to the crest of the ridge over which the big glow was broaching like a sunrise. He tripped once over a wire which he took for some kind of snare, and after that went very warily. And by the by, he got his face between two boulders and looked over into a true battlefield. He told me it was exactly what the predicant used to say that hell would be like. About 50 yards down the slope lay the Turkish trenches. They were very dark against the snow, and now and then a black figure like a devil showed up for an instant and disappeared. The Turks clearly expected an infantry attack, for they were sending up calcium rockets and very flares. The Russians were battering their line and spraying all the hinterland not with shrapnel, but with good solid high explosives. The place would be as bright as day for a moment, all smothered in a scurry of smoke and snow and debris, and then a black pall would fall on it, and only the thunder of the guns told of the battle. Peter felt very sick. He'd not believe there could be so much noise in the world, and the drums of his ears were splitting. Now, for a man to whom courage is habitual, the taste of fear, naked, utter fear, is a horrible thing. It seems to wash away all his manhood. Peter lay on the crest, watching the shells burst, and confident that at any moment he might be a shattered remnant. He lay and reasoned with himself, calling himself every name he could think of, but conscious that nothing would get rid of that lump of ice below his heart. And then he could stand it no longer. He got up and ran for his life, but he ran forward. It was the craziest performance. He went hell for leather over a piece of ground which was being watered with HE, but by the mercy of heaven, nothing hit him. He took some fearsome tosses in shell holes, but partly erect and partly on all fours, he did the 50 yards and tumbled into a Turkish trench right on top of a dead man. The contact with that body brought him to his senses. That men could die at all seemed a comforting, homely thing after that unnatural pandemonium. The next moment, a crump took the parapet of the trench some yards to his left, and he was half buried in an avalanche. He crawled out of that pretty badly cut about the head. He was quite cool now, and thinking hard about his next step. There were men all around him, sullen dark faces as he saw them when the flares went up. They were manning the parapets, and waiting tensely for something else other than shelling. They paid no attention to him, for I fancy in that trench units were pretty well mixed up, and under a bad bombardment no one bothers about his neighbour. He found himself free to move as he pleased. The ground of the trench was littered with empty cartridge cases, and there were many dead bodies. The last shell, as I have said, had played havoc with the parapet. In the next spell of darkness, Peter crawled through the gap and twisted amongst some snowy hillocks. He was no longer afraid of shells, any more than he was afraid of a veld thunderstorm. But he was wondering very hard how he should ever get to the Russians. The Turks were behind him now, and there was the biggest danger in front. Then the artillery ceased. It was so sudden that he thought he had gone deaf, and could hardly realise the blessed relief of it. The wind, too, seemed to have fallen, or perhaps he was sheltered by the lee of a hill. There was a lot of dead here also, and that he couldn't understand, for they were new dead. Had the Turks attacked and been driven back? When he had gone 30 yards, he stopped to take his bearings. On the right were the ruins of a large building set on fire by the guns. There was a blur of woods and debris of the walls around it. Away to the left, another hill ran out farther to the east, and the place he was in seemed to be a kind of cup between the spurs. Just before him was a little ruined building, with the sky seen through its rafters, for the smouldering ruin on the right gave a certain light. He wondered if the Russian firing line lay there. Just then he heard voices, smothered voices, not a yard away and apparently below the ground. He instantly jumped to what this must mean. It was a Turkish trench, a communication trench. Peter didn't know much about modern warfare, but he had read in the papers or heard from me enough to make him draw the right moral. The fresh dead pointed to the same conclusion. What he'd got through were the Turkish support trenches, not their firing line. That was still before him. He didn't despair, for the rebound from panic had made him extra courageous. He crawled forward an inch at a time, taking no sort of risk, and presently found himself looking at the parados of a trench. Then he lay quiet to think about the next step. The shelling had stopped, and there was that queer kind of peace which falls sometimes on two armies not a quarter of a mile distant. Peter said he could hear nothing but the far-off sighing of the wind. There seemed to be no movement of any kind in the trench before him, which ran through the ruined building. The light of the burning was dying, and he could just make out the mound of earth a yard in front. He began to feel hungry, and got out his packet of food and had a swig at the brandy flask. That comforted him, and he felt a master of his fate again. But the next step was not so easy. He must find out what lay behind that mound of earth. Suddenly, a curious sound fell on his ears. It was so faint that at first he doubted the evidence of his senses. Then, as the wind fell, it came louder. It was exactly like some hollow piece of metal being struck by a stick, musical and oddly resonant. He concluded that it was the wind blowing a branch of a tree against an old boiler in the ruin before him. The trouble was that there was scarcely enough wind now for that in his sheltered cup. But as he listened, he caught the note again. It was a bell, a fallen bell, and the place before him must have been a chapel. He remembered that an Armenian monastery had been marked on the map, and he guessed it was the burned building on his right. The thought of a chapel and a bell gave him the notion of some human agency. And then suddenly the notion was confirmed. The sound was regular and concerted. Dot, dash, dot, dash, dot, dot. The branch of a tree and the wind may play some strange pranks, but they do not produce the longs and shorts of the Morse code. This was where Peter's intelligence work in the Boer War helped him. He knew the Morse. He could read it. But he could make nothing of the signalling. It was either in some special code or in a strange language. He lay still and did some calm thinking. There was a man in front of him, a Turkish soldier, who was in the enemy's pay. Therefore he could fraternise with him, for they were on the same side. But how was he to approach him without getting shot in the process? Again, how could a man send signals to the enemy from a firing line without being detected? Peter found an answer in the strange configuration of the ground. He had not heard a sound until he was a few yards from the place, and they would be inaudible to men in the reserve trenches and even in the communication trenches. If somebody moving up the ladder caught the noise, it would be easy to explain it naturally. But the wind blowing down the cup would carry it far in the enemy's direction. There remained the risk of being heard by those parallel with the bell in the firing trenches. Peter concluded that the trench must be very thinly held, probably only by a few observers, and the nearest might be a dozen yards off. He had read about that being the French fashion under a big bombardment. The next thing was to find out how to make himself known to his ally. He decided that the only way was to surprise him. He might get shot, but he trusted to his strength and agility against a man who was almost certainly wearied. When he'd got him safe, explanations might follow. Peter was now enjoying himself hugely. If only those infernal guns kept silent, he would play out the game in the sober, decorous way he loved. He very delicately began to wriggle forward to where the sound was. The night was now as black as ink around him, and very quiet too, except for soughings of the dying gale. The snow had drifted a little in the lee of the ruined walls, and Peter's progress was naturally very slow. He could not afford to dislodge 1 ounce of snow. Still, the tinkling went on, now in greater volume. Peter was in terror, lest it should cease before he got his man. Presently, his hand clutched at empty space. He was on the lip of the front trench. The sound was now a yard to his right, and with infinite care he shifted his position. Now the bell was just below him, and he felt the big rafter of the woodwork from which it had fallen. He felt something else. A stretch of wire fixed in the ground with the far end hanging in the void. That would be the spy's explanation if anyone heard the sound and came seeking the cause. Somewhere in the darkness before him and below was the man, not a yard off. Peter remained very still, studying the situation. He could not see, but he could feel the presence, and he was trying to decide the relative position of the man and bell and their exact distance from him. The thing was not so easy as it looked, for if he jumped for where he believed the figure was, he might miss it and get a bullet in the stomach. A man who played so risky a game was probably handy with his firearms. Besides, if he should hit the bell, he would make a hideous row and alarm the whole front. Fate suddenly gave him the right chance. The unseen figure stood up and moved a step, till his back was against the parados. He actually brushed against Peter's elbow, who held his breath. There is a catch that the Kaffirs have, which would need several diagrams to explain. It is partly a neck hold, and partly a paralyzing backward twist of the right arm. But if it is practiced on a man from behind, it locks him as sure as if he were handcuffed. Peter slowly got his body raised and his knees drawn under him, and reached for his prey. He got him. A head was pulled backward over the edge of the trench, and he felt in the air the motion of the left arm pawing feebly but unable to reach behind. "Be still," whispered Peter in German. "I mean you no harm. We are friends of the same purpose. Do you speak German?" "Nein," was a muffled voice. "English?" "Yes," said the voice. "Thank God," said Peter. "Then we can understand each other. I've watched your notion of signalling, and a very good one it is. I've got to get through to the Russian line somehow before morning, and I want you to help me. I'm English, a kind of English, so we're on the same side. If I let go your neck, will you be good and talk reasonably?" The voice assented. Peter let go, and in the same instant slipped to the side. The man wheeled round and flung out an arm but gripped vacancy. "Steady, friend," said Peter. "You mustn't play tricks with me, or I'll be angry." "Who are you? Who sent you?" asked the puzzled voice. Peter had a happy thought. "The Companions of the Rosy Hours," he said. "Then we are friends indeed," said the voice. "Come out of the darkness, friend, and I will do you no harm. I am a good Turk, and I fought beside the English in the Kordofan and learned their tongue. I live only to see the ruin of Enver, who has beggared my family and slain my twin brother. Therefore I serve the Muskov Girihors." "I don't know what the musky jaws are, but if you mean the Russians, I'm with you. I've got news for them, which will make Enver green. The question is how to get to them, and that's where you shall help me, my friend."
"How?"
"By playing that little tune of yours again. Tell them to expect within the next half hour a deserter with an important message. Tell them, for God's sake, not to fire at anybody until they've made certain it isn't me." The man took the blunt end of his bayonet and squatted beside the bell. The first stroke brought out a clear, searing note which floated down the valley. He struck out three notes at a slow interval. For all the world, Peter said, he was like a telegraph operator calling up a station. "Send the message in English," said Peter. "They may not understand it," said the man. "Then send it any way you like. I trust you, for we are brothers." After 10 minutes, the man ceased and listened. From far away came the sound of a trench gong, the kind of thing they used on the Western Front to give the gas alarm. "They say they will be ready," he said. "I cannot take down messages in the darkness, but they have given me the signal which means consent." "Come, that's pretty good," said Peter. "And now I must be moving. You take a hint from me. When you hear big firing up to the north, get ready to beat a quick retreat, for it will be all with that city of yours. And tell your folk, too, that they are making a bad mistake letting these fool Germans rule their land. Let them hang Enver and his little friends, and we'll be happy once more." "May Satan receive his soul," said the Turk. "There is wire before us, but I'll show you a way through. The guns this evening made many rents in it, but haste, for a working party may be here presently to repair it. Remember, there is much wire before the other lines." Peter, with certain directions, found it pretty easy to make his way through the entanglement. There was one bit which scraped a hole in his back, but very soon he had come to the last posts and found himself in open country. The place, he said, was a graveyard of the unburied dead and smelt horribly as he crawled amongst them. He had no inducements to delay, for he thought he could hear behind him the movement of the Turkish working party, and was in terror that a flare might reveal him and a volley accompany his retreat. From one shell hole to another he wormed his way, till he struck an old ruinous communication trench which led in the right direction. The Turks must have been forced back in the past, and the Russians were now in the evacuated trenches. The thing was half full of water, but it gave Peter a feeling of safety, for it enabled him to get his head below the level of the ground. And then it came to an end, and he found before him a forest of wire. The Turk, in his signal, had mentioned half an hour, but Peter thought it was nearer 2 hours before he got through that noxious entanglement. Shelling had made little difference to it. The uprights were all there, and the barbed strands seemed to touch the ground. Remember, he had no wire cutter, nothing but his bare hands. Once again, fear got hold of him. He felt caught in a net, with monstrous vultures waiting to pounce on him from above. At any moment a flare might go up and a dozen rifles find their mark. He had altogether forgotten about the message which had been sent, for no message could dissuade the ever-present death he felt around him. It was, he said, like following an old lion into bush when there was but one narrow way in and no road out. The guns began again, the Turkish guns from behind the ridge, and a shell tore up the wire a short way before him. Under cover of the burst he made a good few yards, leaving large portions of his clothing on the strands. Then, quite suddenly, when hope had almost died in his heart, he felt the ground rise steeply. He lay very still. A star rocket from the Turkish side lit up the place, and there in front was a rampart with the points of bayonets showing beyond it. It was the Russian hour for stand to. He raised his cramped limbs from the ground and shouted, "Friend! English!" A face looked down at him, and then the darkness again descended. "Friend!" he said hoarsely. "English!" He heard speech behind the parapet. An electric torch was flashed on him for a second. A voice spoke, a friendly voice, and the sound of it seemed to be telling him to come over. He was now standing up, and as he got his hands on the parapet, he seemed to feel bayonets very near him. But the voice that spoke was kindly, so with a heave he scrambled over and flopped into the trench. Once more the electric torch was flashed and revealed to the eyes of the onlookers an indescribably dirty, lean, middle-aged man with a bloody head and scarcely a rag of shirt on his back. The said man, seeing friendly faces around him, grinned cheerfully. "That was a rough trek, friends," he said. "I want to see your general pretty quick, for I've got a present for him." He was taken to an officer in a dugout, who addressed him in French which he did not understand. But the sight of Stumm's plan worked wonders. After that, he was fairly bundled down the communication trenches and over swampy fields to a farm amongst the trees. There he found staff officers, who looked at him and looked at his map, and then put him on a horse and hurried him eastwards. At last he came to a big ruined house, and was taken into a room which seemed to be full of maps and generals. The conclusion must be told in Peter's own words. There was a big man sitting at a table drinking coffee, and when I saw him my heart jumped out of my skin, for it was the man I hunted with on the Pungwe in 98, him who the Kaffirs called Buck's Horn, because of his long curled moustaches. He was a prince even then, and now he is a very great general. When I saw him I ran forward and gripped his hand and cried, "Ho, Gaffer, mein Heer!" And he knew me and shouted in Dutch, "Damn if it isn't the old Peter Pienaar!" And then he gave me coffee and ham and good bread, and he looked at my map. "What is this?" he cried, growing red in the face. "It is the staff map of one Stum, a General Skellum, who commands in yon city," I said. He looked at it close and read the markings, and then he read the other paper which you gave me, Dick, and then he flung up his arms and laughed. He took a loaf and tossed it into the air so that it fell on the head of another general. He spoke to them in their own tongue, and they too laughed, and one or two ran out as if on some errand. I'd never seen such merrymaking. They were clever men, and they knew the worth of what you gave me. Then he got to his feet and hugged me, all dirty as I was, and kissed me on both cheeks. "Before God, Peter," he said, "you're the mightiest hunter since Nimrod. You've often found me game, but never so big game as this." Today's music is a throwback to the podcast's Helen Kane special. This is "I've Got It" by Helen Kane. Now it's time to get back to the King in Yellow, with the second and final part of Demoiselle d'Ise. Part 2. I awoke next morning with the music of the horn in my ears, and leaping out of the ancient bed went to the curtained window where the sunlight filtered through the little deep-set panes. The horn ceased as I looked into the court below. A man who might have been brother to the two falconers of the night before stood in the midst of a pack of hounds. A curved horn was strapped over his back, and in his hand he held a long-lashed whip. The dogs whined and yelped, dancing around him in anticipation. There was the stamp of horses, too, in the walled yard.
"Mount!" cried a voice in Breton.
With a clatter of hooves, the two falconers, with falcons upon their wrists, rode into the courtyard amongst the hounds. Then I heard another voice which sent the blood throbbing through my heart. "Pirieu, Louis, hunt the hounds well, and spare neither the spur nor whip. Thou, Rouel, and thou, Gaston, see that the épivier does not prove himself naïs, and if it be the best in your judgment, faites cortes elle osse, je donne un osse. Like me, there on Hastur's wrist, it is not difficult. But thou, Raoul, mayest not find it so simple to govern thy haggard. Twice last week he firmed au vive and lost the becard, although he is used to the lure. The bird acts like a stupid branchier, pate un haggard nest per se facile." Was I dreaming? The old language of falconry which I had read in yellow manuscripts, the old forgotten French of the Middle Ages, was sounding in my ears while the hounds bayed and the hawks' bells tinkled accompaniment to the stamping horses. She spoke again in the sweet forgotten language. "If you would rather attach the longe and leave thy haggard au bloc, Raoul, I shall say nothing, for it were a pity to spoil so fair a day's sport with an ill-trained source. A semier basse, it is possibly the best way. C'est le donner de rein. I was perhaps hasty with the bird. It takes a pass à la filière, and the exercises d'escape." Then the falconer Raoul bowed in his stirrups and replied, "If it be the pleasure of mademoiselle, I shall keep the hawk." "It is my wish," she answered. "Falconry I know, but you have yet to give me a lesson in the autosserie. My poor Raoul. Sire Pirieu Louis, mount." The huntsman sprang into the archway, and in an instant returned mounted upon a black horse, followed by a piqueur also mounted. "Ah!" she cried joyously. "Speed, Glemarach René! Speed, speed all! Speed thy horn, Sire Pirieu!" The silvery music of the hunting horn filled the courtyard. The hounds sprang through the gateway, and galloping hoofbeats plunged out of the paved court, loud on the drawbridge, suddenly muffled, and then lost in the heather and bracken of the moors. Distant and more distant sounded the horn, until it became so faint that the sudden carol of a soaring lark drowned it in my ears. I heard the voice below responding to some call from within the house. "I do not regret the chase. I will go another time. Courtesy to the stranger, Pelagie, remember?" And a feeble voice came quivering from within the house. "Courtesy!" I stripped and rubbed myself from head to foot in the huge earthen basin of icy water which stood upon the stone floor at the foot of my bed. And then I looked about for my clothes. They were gone. But on a settle near the door lay a heap of garments which I inspected with astonishment. As my clothes had vanished, I was compelled to attire myself in the costume which had evidently been placed there for me to wear while my own clothes were drying. Everything was there, cap, shoes, and hunting doublet of silvery grey homespun. But the close-fitting costume and seamless shoes belonged to another century, and I remembered the strange costumes of the three falconers in the courtyard. I was sure that it was not the modern dress of any portion of France or Brittany, but did not until I was dressed stood before the mirror between the windows did I realise that I was clothed much more like a young huntsman of the Middle Ages than like a Breton of that day. I hesitated and picked up the cap. Should I go down and present myself in that strange guise? There seemed to be no help for it. My own clothes were gone, and there was no bell in the ancient chamber to call a servant. So I contented myself with removing a short hawk's feather from the cap, and opening the door, went downstairs. By the fireplace in the large room at the foot of the stairs, an old Breton woman sat spinning with a distaff. She looked up at me when I appeared, and smiling frankly wished me health in the Breton language, to which I laughingly replied in French. At the same moment my hostess appeared, and returned my salutation with a grace and dignity that sent a thrill to my heart. Her lovely head, with its dark curly hair, was crowned with a headdress, which set all doubts as to the epoch of my own costume at rest. Her slender figure was exquisitely set off in the homespun hunting gown edged with silver, and on her gauntlet-covered wrist she bore one of her petted hawks. With perfect simplicity, she took my hand and led me into the garden in the court, and seating herself before a table, invited me very sweetly to sit beside her. Then she asked me in her soft, quaint accent how I had passed the night, and whether I was very much inconvenienced by wearing the clothes which old Pellegrie had put there for me while I slept. I looked at my own clothes and shoes, drying in the sun by the garden wall, and hated them. What horrors they were compared with the graceful costume which I now wore! I told her this, laughing, but she agreed with me very seriously. "I will throw them away," she said in a quiet voice. In my astonishment I attempted to explain that I not only could not think of accepting clothes from anybody, although for all I knew it might be the custom of hospitality in that part of the country, but that I should not cut an impossible figure if I returned to France clothed as I was then. She laughed and tossed her pretty head, saying something in old French which I did not understand, and then Pelagie trotted out with a tray on which stood two bowls of milk, a loaf of white bread, fruit, a platter of honeycomb, and a flagon of deep red wine. "You see, I have not yet broken my fast, because I wished you to eat with me. But I am very hungry," she smiled. "I would rather die than forget one word of what you have said," I blurted out, while my cheeks burned. "She will think me mad," I added to myself. But she turned to me with sparkling eyes. "Ah," she murmured, "then Monsieur knows all there is of chivalry." She crossed herself and broke bread. I sat and watched her white hands, not daring to raise my eyes to hers. "Will you not eat?" she asked. "Why do you look so troubled?" Ah, why? I knew it now. I knew I would give my life to touch with my lips those rosy palms. I understood now that from the moment when I looked into her dark eyes, there on the moor last night, I had loved her. My great and sudden passion held me speechless. "Are you ill at ease?" she asked again. Then, like a man who pronounces his own doom, I answered in a low voice, "Yes, I am ill at ease for love of you." And as she did not stir nor answer, the same power moved my lips in spite of me, and I said, "I, who am an unworthy of the lightest of your thoughts, I who abuse hospitality and repay your gentle courtesy with bold presumption, I love you." She leaned her head upon her hands and answered softly, "I love you. Your words are very dear to me. I love you." "Then I shall win you." "Win me," she replied. But all the time I'd been sitting silent, my face turned toward her. She, also silent, her sweet face resting on her upturned palm, sat facing me, and as her eyes looked into mine, I knew that neither she nor I had spoken human speech. But I knew that her soul had answered mine, and I drew myself up feeling youth and joyous love coursing through every vein. She, with a bright colour in her lovely face, seemed as one awakened from a dream, and her eye sought mine with a questioning glance which made me tremble with delight. We broke our fast, speaking of ourselves. I told her my name, and she told me hers, the Demoiselle Jeanne d'Ys. She spoke of her father and mother's death, and how the 19 of her years had been passed in the little fortified farm alone with her nurse Pelagie, Glemarac, René, the piqueur, the four falconers, Raoul, Gaston, Haster, and the Sieur Pirelouis, who had served her father. She had never been outside the moorland, never even seen a human soul before except the falconers and Pellegrie. She did not know how she had heard of Kerselec. Perhaps the falconers had spoken of it. She knew the legends of Loup-Garou and Jean Lafarme from her nurse Pelagie. and embroidered and spun flax. Her hawks and hounds were her only distraction. When she had met me, there on the moor, she had been so frightened that she almost dropped at the sound of my voice. She had, it was true, seen ships at sea from the cliffs, but as far as the eye could reach, the moors over which she galloped were destitute of any sign of human life. There was a legend, which old Pellegree told, how anybody once lost in the unexplored moorland might never return, because the moors were enchanted. She did not know whether it was true. She never had thought about it until she met me. She did not know whether the Falconers had even been outside, or whether they could go if they would. The books in the house, which Pellegree, the nurse, had taught her to read, were hundreds of years old. All this, she told me, with a sweet seriousness seldom seen in anyone but children. My own name she found easy to pronounce, but insisted, because my first name was Philip, that I must have French blood in me. She did not seem curious to learn anything about the outside world, and I thought perhaps she considered it had forfeited her interest and respect from the stories of her nurse. We were still sitting at the table, and she was throwing grapes to the small field birds, which came fearlessly to our feet. I began to speak in vague terms of going, but she would not hear of it, and before I knew it, I had promised to stay a week and hunt with hawk and hound in their company. I also obtained permission to come again from Kerselec and visit her after my return. "Why," she said innocently, "I do not know that what I should do if you never came back." And I, knowing that I had no right to awaken her with sudden shock which the avowal of my love would bring to her, sat silent, hardly daring to breathe. "You will come very often?" she asked. "Very often," I said. "Every day?" "Every day." "Oh," she sighed, "I am very happy. Come and see my hawks." She rose and took my hand again with a childlike innocence of possession, and we walked through the garden and fruit trees to a grassy lawn which was bordered by a brook. Over the lawn were scattered 15 or 20 stumps of trees, partially embedded in the grass, and upon all of these, except two, sat falcons. They were attached to the stumps by thongs, which were in turn fastened with steel rivets to their legs just above the talons. A little stream of pure spring water flowed in a winding course within easy distance of each perch. The birds set up a clamour when the girl appeared, but she went from one to another, caressing some, taking others for an instant upon her wrist, or stooping to adjust their jesses. "Are they not pretty?" she asked. "See, here is a falcon gentle. We call it ignoble because it takes the quarry in direct chase. This is a blue falcon. In falconry, we call it noble because it rises over the quarry and, wheeling, drops upon it from above. This white bird is a ger falcon from the north. It is also noble. And here is Merlin, and this, Tiercelet, is a falcon heroner." I asked her how she had learned the old language of falconry. She did not remember, but thought her father must have taught it to her when she was very young. Then she led me away and showed me the young falcons still in the nest. "They are termed nayals in falconry," she explained. "A branchier is the young bird which is just able to leave the nest and hop from branch to branch. A young bird which has not yet molted is called a sors, and a mew is a hawk which has molted in captivity. When we catch a wild falcon, which has changed its plumage, we term it a haggard. Raoul first taught me to dress a falcon. Shall I teach you how it's done?" She seated herself on the bank of the stream amongst the falcons, and I threw myself at her feet to listen. Then the Demoiselle d'Ys held up one rosy-tipped finger and began very gravely. "First, one must catch the falcon." "I am caught," I answered. She laughed very prettily and told me my dressage would perhaps be difficult, as I was noble. "I am already tamed," I replied, "jessed and belled." She laughed delighted. "Oh, my brave falcon, and then you will return at my call?" "I am yours," I answered gravely. She sat silent for a moment. Then the colour heightened in her cheeks, and she held up her finger again, saying, "Listen, I wish to speak of falconry." I listen, Countess Jean d'Ys. But again she fell into reverie, and her eyes seemed fixed on something beyond the summer clouds. Philippe, she said at last. Jean, I replied. That is all. That is all I wished, she replied. Philippe and Jean. She held her hand toward me, and I touched it with my lips. Win me, she said, but this time it was the body and soul which spoke in unison. After a while she began again. Let us speak of falconry. Begin, I replied. We have caught the falcon. Then Jean d'Ys took my hand in both of hers and told me how with infinite patience the young falcon was taught to perch upon the wrist, how little by little it became used to the belled jesses and the chaperon au cornet. They must first have a good appetite, she said. Then little by little I reduced their nourishment, which in falconry we call pat. When after many nights passed, ou bloc as these birds are now, I prevail upon the haggard to stay quietly on the wrist, and then the bird is ready to be taught to come for its food. I fix the pat to the end of a thong or a lure, and teach the bird to come to me as soon as I begin to whirl the cord in circles about my head. At first I drop the pat when the falcon comes, and he eats the food on the ground. After a little, he will learn to seize the lure in motion as I whirl it around my head or drag it over the ground. After this, it is easy to teach the falcon to strike at game, always remembering the faire courtier il y osait, that is, to allow the bird to taste the quarry. A squeal from one of the falcons interrupted her, and she arose to adjust the long which had been whipped about the block, but the bird still flapped its wings and screamed. What is the matter? She said. Philippe, can you see? I looked around at first, saw nothing to cause the commotion, which was now heightened by the screams and flapping of all the birds. And then my eye fell upon the flat rock beside the stream from which the girl had risen. A grey serpent was moving slowly across the surface of the boulder, and the eyes in its flat triangular head sparkled like jet. A couleuvre, she said quietly. It is harmless, is it not? I asked. She pointed at the black V-shaped figure on the neck. It is certain death, she said. It is a viper. We watched the reptile moving slowly over the smooth rock to where the sunlight fell in a broad warm patch. I started forward to examine it, but she clung to my arm, crying, Don't, Philippe, I am afraid. For me? For you, Philippe. I love you. And then I took her in my arms and kissed her on the lips. But all I could say was, Jean, Jean, Jean. And she lay trembling on my breast. Something struck my foot in the grass below, but I did not heed it. Then again something struck my ankle, and a sharp pain shot through me. I looked into the sweet face of Jean d'Ys and kissed her, and with all my strength lifted her in my arms and flung her from me. Then bending I tore the viper from my ankle, and set my heel upon its head. I remember feeling weak and numb. I remember falling to the ground. Through my slowly glazing eyes, I saw Jean's white face bending close to mine, and when the light in my eyes went out, I still felt her arms about my neck and her soft cheek against my drawn lips. When I opened my eyes, I looked around in terror. Jean was gone. I saw the stream and the flat rock. I saw the crushed viper in the grass beside me. But the hawks and blocks had disappeared. I sprang to my feet. The garden, the fruit trees, the drawbridge and the walled court were gone. I stared stupidly at a heap of crumbling ruins, ivy-covered and grey, through which great trees had pushed their way. I crept forward, dragging my numbed foot as I moved. A falcon sailed from the treetops amongst the ruins, and soaring, mounting in narrow circles, faded and vanished in the clouds above. Jean! Jean! I cried, but my voice died on my lips, and I fell on my knees amongst the weeds. And as God willed it, I, not knowing, had fallen kneeling before a crumbling shrine carved in stone for our Mother of Sorrows. I saw the sad face of the Virgin wrought in the cold stone. I saw the cross and thorns at her feet. And beneath it I read, "Pray for the soul of the Demoiselle Jeanne d'Ys, who died in her youth for love of Philippe, a stranger, A.D. 1573. But upon the icy slab lay a woman's glove, still warm and fragrant.
The King in Yellow continues next time. Well, that's it for today, except to remind you that my narration of the 39 Steps, the prequel to Green Mantle, is now available as an audiobook from audible.com. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.